Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. Welcome back. You are listening to the only show on air that asserts the constitutional solution to getting the general government back into the framework of the Constitution. In other words, getting them back into scope of what they're supposed to be doing and out of doing those things that they have no constitutional authority, power, or responsibility over. This show is dedicated in supporting the election and those state legislators who are willing to commit to protecting their citizens from federal tyranny. In part with this, this show is also dedicated to those county grassroots leaders. This means that those grassroots leaders and those state legislators that are willing to commit to supporting the Constitution and living up to their oath of office, what that means is they're willing to protect all of us from federal tyranny. So I just want you to fathom that, because those are actually some big britches to fill. And so let me give you the good news. I actually scoured the different newses and have checked and purviewed my window and the news agencies and so forth. But the bad news is the federal government has had no efforts and is no interest at this point in time in disbanding any of their tyrannical roles, responsibilities, and powers. So, of course, that leaves it to us. We're going to have to do this. And I hope that you're one adult enough, mature enough, and willing to step up and take a little bit of heat. Because once one person stands up, it makes it easier for everybody else to. And that's one of the reasons why I'm asserting if I can get one state to take the courage and take a stand against Goliath, the other states will come and we will have enough of a quorum to be able to take on these unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers that have been usurped. I still have that open question, but tomorrow will be Open Question Friday. So if you have something that you want to ask or something you want to submit to the audience, by all means, that's tomorrow. But today, my interest is the same. What or where in the Constitution gives the federal government the authority to create and manage land for the intent and purposes of reservations for preserving, whether that be races, cultures, animals, trees, whatever? Help me find that in the Constitution, would you please? That being said, as you know, June 21st to the 23rd, I've been talking about this. This is the place to be for those particular days. Is the Spokane area. It is the Red Pill Expo. If you go to redpillexpo.com, or actually redpillexpo.org, not .com, you might actually get some medicine at redpillexpo.com. But anyway, redpillexpo.org is where you can get all the details and you can find out what it takes. And as a matter of fact, I would highly recommend using Alaskan Airlines to fly into the Spokane area if you're not in this area, because they provide probably the best service on time and probably all the flexibility that you need, whether you're connecting a link from Seattle, Portland, or what have you, or whether you're flying direct. I would recommend Alaskan Airlines for what it's worth, because they'll probably have the most competitive rates and probably the best schedule and so forth and so on and so on. Anyway, as everybody knows, the North Korean summit is called off, and it makes me think, why would a despot even care for what is best for their society and their people? Why would they even consider those who are in plight and so forth? I mean, it's like, I don't know if it was Thomas Sowell or somebody. I remember reading a book when they talked about trying to free slavery back in ancient Rome. Had you gone to Caesar and said, hey, you can get rid of all your slaves because with today's modern society, you can have running water, hot and cold, and you can have all the food, you know, refrigerated right there and available to you and so forth. And Caesar would look at you like you're crazy because he already has those things. He has everything he would want when he wants it, and it better be on time or heads will roll. And that's what despots do. They don't care about whether those amenities and those things that improve the quality of life are available to their citizens. They only care about what they have and when they have it, and it better be on time and the way they want it. So you cannot look at despots in the same kind of light as a normal person, because they don't understand those, the human condition. They do not understand those intricacies of the human condition. Good leaders do, but despots don't. And so I don't think we should be putting too much credibility with this despot in North Korea. I think that Kim Jong-un is more of one who is really looking out for his own image and how he looks and how he's being perceived. It's all about him. And so I think that's one of the reasons why Trump was successful in getting some concessions, at least getting them to start changing their paradigm, because he was poking at him. And as you know, or you may not have heard, the House Democrats are inviting students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, to come up to intern in their offices this summer in working on gun control measures. Are you surprised? Are you surprised the politicizing of this disaster and what they're trying to do? It is, I guess, well within the realms of what one can expect from an ideology and those people who subscribe to that ideology of subjugation. And so here they have these kids that are going to get the limelight. And I've talked to a lot of people about this, and there's very few people that will disagree with me that what we have coming out of our schools, we have kids salivating, waiting for the day that they can go into the election booths and surrender your liberties as well as theirs, because that's what's really important. And that's what they've been programmed to do. It is their destiny to surrender our liberties so that we can be subjugated to the greatest state and the greatest government in the world, which will quickly become a world government, or if not already by that time. I really regret the day that we're going to see this wave, because as I was telling people, if you go look at the demographics, there are probably 10 million, or maybe a little less than that, maybe 8 million students that are turning 18 each year. So if you look at the population over the span of the next 10 years, 5 years even, how long will it take to where we have enough kids coming into the school system to be able to participate in this historic event of surrendering liberty? This is a pretty scary, and that's one of the reasons why I tell you, and I've pointed to these facts before, that we only have a few years left if we are going to save our constitutional republic. So that's why this year, this election year, it's very critical that I hope to count on you, that you can equally contribute or at least provide some type of contributions to these people who are willing to commit to saving the Constitution and supporting the Constitution and making the federal government get back into that framework and scope of the Constitution, as I always start each show off with. So, therefore, let me find out if there's any other news that's worth reporting. Oh, yeah. Is it any surprise that the unconstitutional agencies such as the FBI is inserting informants? I believe that there have been, and as a matter of fact, I think if you're following the Bundy, Finnecum, Lavoie Finnecum trials and so forth, you'll probably find there were all sorts of informants from different types of agencies placed into these camps and so forth. And they took a lot of time in doing this, and it was a very sophisticated operation. And it's interesting how people are just being shocked. And I'm telling you that we're just brushing the surface on how deep this corruption is in D.C. I'm telling you. that when we get to a point where we're actually seeing these things, we're tripping over these things, that means that it is a far greater and more systemic of a problem than anybody is going to really want to admit, and it's going to get ugly. The other nice thing is that Trump did roll back Dodd-Frank, but I would like to just throw this out there. How about disbanding the SEC altogether? I understand that the SEC gets rid of all of these supposed protections, but it also gets rid of all of these strings and these controls and so forth. And so with that, I would like to, you know, throw that out there, that if you look at what we have with the Dodd-Frank and even the Sarbanes-Oxley and all of these other types of controls, they have been more of a hindrance to our economy. And I don't believe it is the federal government's role. If you want the federal government, it's not in the Constitution. If you really want them to have an SEC, if you want them to manage these types of things, then I would just submit to you that you may want to consider actually looking at these agencies as disbanding and forcing the states. Actually, New York should be the one that should be stepping up and managing and overseeing, because it is in their best interest, because the profits that they make right there in their state boundaries, they're making money off of. That is why I've railed over the TARP bailouts, because that was an ununiform tax placed upon the United States that was granted to the state of New York, where none other states received trillions of dollars like New York did over that fiasco. That's why we've just got to get rid of this. If you really want it, amend the Constitution. If not, then let's just move forward and put these things behind us. Anyway, we're at a hard break, and I will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Thank you so much. Did you know your overall health is connected to your dental health? As you get older, this becomes more and more important. If you're like me, going to the dentist can be terrifying. So for me to maintain my dental and overall health, I need a great dentist and staff who are sensitive to my fear, pain, and even my fear of the cost of dental work. This is why it took me almost 2 years to find a great dentist after moving into this area. Bottom line, I need a great dentist just to get into the chair, even for a regular cleaning. This is why I personally recommend Dr. Vaughn Tracy as not only a great dentist, but a great patriot and a dentist who cares about your comfort and health. You can find him at VaughnTracyDDS.com. That's VaughnTracyDDS.com. Then you can agree with me, it's great to have a great dentist. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I'm trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
And so, as I was just saying, if you really want to get rid of unconstitutional government, we really have to start looking at those types of things, such as the SEC and so forth. I do believe there's solutions for this and actually providing protection, but I do not believe it is the business of the federal government to actually, go down this path of managing your retirement and managing all of these types of things that I would venture to say are well outside those boundaries of the Constitution. And so anyway, I want you all to also know I'm having some phone problems, and so we're hoping to be able
Welcome
to get
back.
This
Hope have a great show.
There we go. So that's the kind of the nice thing that I like to have. That's what we get here. So we're back online if you do want to call in. I've been trying to struggle with that while we've been talking. Anyway, back on to the subject today, because I told you we were going to get into the constitutional debates within New York. And what I wanted to do was give you a perspective of New York with regard to the Constitutional Convention and the ratification debates, because understanding the big picture kind of really helps. Because as you know, and as I've mentioned before, you may not know, but I've mentioned this before, that when they were ratifying the Constitution, the two states that had to be a part of this process, that had to be within the Constitution, was the state of New York and the state of Virginia. And so what I will tell you is that when they were ratifying and they had nine states, neither Virginia nor New York had ratified yet. And so based on the contract or based on the Constitution, the federal government was supposed to form. But why didn't they? Because the two commerce powers, even though Massachusetts was considered a good base for commerce, it had good ports and so forth, it just didn't have the flow of commerce like New York and Virginia. So therefore, they considered the amount of revenues and the amount of commerce that was coming out of these two states going to be critical for the funding of this new government. So that's why there was really no big celebration when the ninth state ratified, and I think that was New Hampshire. The critical thing that I want you to understand is, out of the convention or out of the delegates, one would think, because if you look at some of the states and how many delegates that they sent, some of these small states sent quite a few delegates. Virginia sent 5. And the interesting thing is, New York only sent 3. And as a matter of fact, I think Governor Clinton was very, very concerned with this amendment process. And as a matter of fact, I believe that there was a lot of fervor going back and forth between the convention and what was going on in New York, because it was documented that Hamilton and Lansing and Yates actually went in and out of the debates. And I think that at points in time during the Constitutional Convention, there was no delegate from New York. And I believe only Hamilton returned, and he was the only delegate from New York that signed the Constitution. So in other words, Lansing and Yates were probably opposers, or they were hostile towards this new form of republic or constitutional republic that was coming out of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. And So, and as a matter of fact, the beautiful thing about this time of year is this is when it happened. If you understand, this coming Sunday is the day, and I think I mentioned this earlier this week, this coming Sunday is the day that they actually formed the Constitutional Convention in Independence Hall in Philadelphia. And if you understand that, you know, throughout the summertime, this coming summer, there are all sorts of dates that coincide with what was going on during that Constitutional Convention. I've mentioned August 22nd as the day when they finally closed the deal on slavery was not going to get shut down because three states took the rest of the Union hostage over that. And so anyway, I don't want to digress too much, but the whole point is that when they started forming the constitutional debates in New York for the ratification of the Constitution, the three primary advocates, or I should say Federalists, for the Constitution was Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and Chancellor Livingston. Not one of those two, other than Alexander. So Alexander Hamilton, of course, was the delegate. John Jay was not a delegate at the Constitutional Convention, nor was Chancellor Livingston a delegate. And so the onus was on Hamilton to feed them the Federalist Papers, as well as kind of bring them up to speed with everything that was agreed upon. That's really why when you read, and I will tell you, if you compare the volume of the New York debates compared to the Virginia debates, there are obviously more notes regarding the New York debates than there were Virginia. But you'll find that there was a lot of hyperbole coming out of Alexander. And I think Chancellor Livingston and actually John Jay were a little bit better in being concise as to getting to the point and clearly defining the limitations of the federal government and so forth, because they were going through the exact same things in every other state that the anti-federalists were saying, this is an all-powerful government that has, you know, no limitations at all. And that was absolutely a lie. The anti-federalists were trying to do anything and everything not to allow the Union to preserve itself. A lot of them in the New York debates actually started going down this road and started selling this concept. You know, we're just a couple of years away from posterity or prosperity. I always get those two mixed up. I apologize. Anyway, they were trying to basically convince people that pretty soon they were going to be able to start, you know, harvesting crops out of their wasteland, and they were going to start clearing trees, and they were going to have all of these things start coming forth out of the state of New York, that they're just, you know, hold on, just give us a couple of more years. But they didn't realize that the debts of the Articles of Confederation, or I should say the Continental Congress, were starting to stack up, and the debtors, France, Holland, and other countries, were starting to say, hey, you need to pay us. And they were getting very concerned. The harassment was starting to get a little closer to home, and the Continental Congress had no power to do anything, and they were getting hostility from the states. Many of the states were not paying their debt. We got to remember that the catalyst in causing this constitutional convention to occur was Shays' Rebellion up in Massachusetts. So anyway, I'm trying to give you a little bit of history and put this into context, why this was really important. And as I've said before, there are entities, organizations, and people that are asserting that the Constitutional Convention was a runaway convention. And I would invite, maybe I will read or get into and highlight some excerpts from the, what I will call the Federalist Paper number 40, which is when Madison himself was very upset when he was basically being told that he had a runaway convention. And so I just kind of want to leave that out there, but let me move forward. So we had Hamilton, Jay, and Chancellor were the three big advocates. And guess who was the opponent to the Constitution? John Lansing, who was actually a delegate, and Governor George Clinton, probably the most influential person in all of New York, was using every bit of his power to stop this Constitution from getting ratified. So there was a Melancton Smith was another proponent, and he was a very vocal opponent against the Constitution. And so I think I read one of his statements yesterday. But the point is that it seemed like the odds were really stacked against New York. And the way I see New York's ratification process really went down was more of, you know, it was kind of like the final nail that that sealed the fate of the Constitution, and getting ratified in New York had little less to do with the prowess and the ability for Hamilton to convince the delegates of New York, because it just seemed like it was that close of a debate. I believe that the thing that really turned New York was more of the fact that Virginia was going to be a state in the new union. And even though you'll find that there were many, many other ulterior efforts after the Constitutional Convention, or I should say the ratification debates, had finally succeeded, I think you'll find that there were plenty of others that were trying to undermine the Constitution. But we got a hard break, so we'll be right back after word from our sponsors, and I'll get more into this. Most of my listeners understand the importance in having strategic goals, but do you have a long-term strategy for your dental health? Too many people are only focused on whitening their smile. I understand the appearance of your teeth can give you confidence, but this can risk your future health in only addressing the cosmetics of your teeth, and many dentists will take your money just to do this. They say failing to plan is planning to fail, and if you don't have a long-term strategy for your teeth and dental health, then you need a new dentist. Every dentist provides a dental plan, but Dr. Tracy and his staff develops a strategy to help you maintain and restore your dental health to what it needs to be. To develop a strategy in maintaining your dental health, connect with Dr. Von Tracy, DDS.com. That's VonTracyDDS.com. So you too can develop a strategy in maintaining your dental health. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open. Well, I'm hoping the lines are open. I've had nothing but difficulty this whole time. I've been bouncing back and forth with the phone system. So I don't know what the difficulties are, but hopefully They'll stay open this time. So if those of you who've been trying to call, by all means, if you want to call, try again. Anyway, just to give you some highlights of the New York ratification debates before I actually start getting into some of the meat, Chancellor Livingston really, and he was, again, a proponent for the Constitution and a Federalist. He basically tried to set the tone, and he basically got everybody to agree with the concept that what they wanted to do was go through the Constitution in a systematic manner. He said that with the limitation of time, because you've got to remember, they were only budgeted for salaries for a very specific time. This kind of goes, I'm going to go on a little aside here. When you look at the Convention of States project, when you look at the Article 5 application, I've asked all sorts of leaders with, you know, directors and so forth, and nobody can tell you what is the specified amount of time. I mean, apparently they believe that there's this unlimited amount of money that they can just go, well, it'll whatever it takes, you know, we're going to have to go in and it's going to be a lot. Well, you know, they never did that with the Constitutional Convention. They had a set schedule and they basically stuck to it and they got out of there on time. It's the same thing with the ratification debates. They knew that they had to get through it and be done by a certain period of time. Now, there were some states like Rhode Island that never even honored the ratification process. They didn't even form a ratification debate or even called for one. And well, until like 2-3 years after the fact, after they had received the Constitution and watched the Republic start to stand up around them, I believe South Carolina was another one. They did not join the Union until, I think, when the Bill of Rights started circling through at about that point in time. I think they felt the pressure. But anyway, Chancellor Livingston started to set this tone, and he basically said, let's go through this logically because we have a finite amount of time, and so we need to go through this to make sure that we cover everything and not just jump and skip something, which made a lot of sense to the Anti-Federalists because they wanted to be able to uncover every little nook and cranny that they hated, that they wanted to bring forth as fruit of, this is the evil fruit of this Constitution type of thing. And so, of course, they started with the preamble, and I don't think that there were a lot of fireworks over that. I think the first thing that really started setting up some fireworks, and it's kind of interesting because it was an equally debated and heated issue within the Constitutional Convention itself, which was the ratio of representation. When they got into the scheme of this representation in the House of Representatives, they basically said, is the proposed ratio of 1 to 30, in other words, one representative for every 30,000, so it, when you have more than 30,000, you get another representative until you hit that next threshold of 30,000, then you get another representative till you hit that next threshold and so forth. And so that ratio of 1 to 30,000, they were debating whether it was large enough to pass the twin tests of sufficiently adequate to represent the people and the interest of the people, and also to discourage corruption of the representatives. In other words, they didn't want to have a small enough government. And so they were repeating a lot of the same arguments that occurred during the Constitutional Convention. And I tell many people this, that what was discussed and what they came to the conclusion within that Constitutional Convention, they practically vetted the Anti-Federalist arguments because there were plenty of people that were very suspicious of what they were doing during the Constitutional Convention, and they wanted to make sure that it was going to pass the smell test as this went out to the states for ratification. And so, as they continued on, one of the other big undertones regarding this representation was the cost of government. I believe that also came up in Virginia as well. Henry basically said that who's going to pay for this big government? And of course, they knew who was going to pay for it, but he was trying to point out the fact that, hey, things aren't free, that you're going to have to be paying the salary. And for some reason, back in those days, civic duty was just one of those things that we had to do. It was a thing that you shouldn't be making $1 million off of serving the people. And I get that. But I also have a personal problem with the fact that we're asking people to go in and take a breather of their life. And life isn't cheap. If you, I brought this up with the Idaho representation. I think it was $17,000 is their salary, and then they get a per diem on top of that. And if you understand $17,000 and with their per diem of a standard session, that's still well underneath the poverty rolls of people that are writing laws that have to be, you know, enforced and so forth. I don't think we're doing ourselves a good service. And so I think we're better off getting away from this golden retirement of our public officials and giving them an honest compensation that can compete, because I truly believe that there is a greater temptation for a public servant to be able to figure out how he can make a little bit more money to get by, to, you know, pay for, you know, his daughter's braces or his son's, you know, endeavors in athletics or what have you. I don't think that they should be having to try to focus on, you know, trying to make an honest compensation while they're contributing to doing good things in government. I think it's really important that we take away their temptation of trying to take money or being proposed to taking money. And then what we want to do is, shoot, put in the death penalty if they take money, if we catch them funneling money like we see some of these Democrats in California. I remember one was throwing money to their daughters and their children in the education system and so forth. Give them the death penalty when they do things like that. Make a very stiff penalty that if they take money or they use government money for, you know, shoveling money towards their family or what have you, which is, you know, something that's unethical, they shouldn't be doing that, then let them pay the consequences. There should be consequences for that type of behavior instead of a just slap on the wrist. I mean, just a couple of years in jail, that should not be. Defying the public trust when you've been given that should have a sincere and heavy consequence that comes with that. But anyway, the undertone in both Virginia and New York, and probably in all of the ratification debates, even though Delaware didn't really debate, I think that there was still this undertone of how are we going to pay for this? And I think that they knew that some would be having to pay these salaries and created a bloated government, like I said. But I think others kind of understood, because even Adam Smith in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations said, there is a cost to government. You have to keep a balance of what government should cost and how government should serve you, because you got to be very careful. All of a sudden, when you start paying a lot of money for government, then government can get pretty creative with how they spend your money. And so that's one of the reasons why the framers were very guarded in holding those controls. So those controls were clearly set in Article 1, Section 8. And that's when it really started getting heated in the discussions. And the delegates, as they started going through Article 1, Section 8, that's where, because the reason Article 1, Section 8 is important is that's where the enumerated powers are for Congress. And Williams, one of the delegates, considered the restrictions on, and he was an anti-federalist, he considered the restrictions on the congressional power to be inadequate. And in particular, he was concerned that the state governments are not provided with enough source of revenue that he felt that the federal government would be able to just take. And I'm telling you that there were similar conversations in the Virginia ratification debates. If you go back and listen to those podcasts when I talked about that, they were literally believing that the federal government would just take all the money, there wouldn't be nothing left, and the state governments would wither on the vine. And That was never the case, but it is now because the states have rolled over. The states had the supremacy over all things not delegated, and the federal government was literally only taxing for those things that were necessary and proper to basically exercise those powers within the Constitution and nothing more. And that's why they were a success for so long. Anyway, we've got a little bit more, and I'm actually going to get into the writings of Hamilton, but we'll have to get into that after we get back from a break. We'll be right back. It's that time of year to get that dental checkup and cleaning. I know many of us are creatures of habit, and we tend to settle for what we know, and many of us are procrastinators. I was that way myself with my past dentist, jumping from one dentist chair to the next. From all the hopping, I've learned that all dentists are not equal, and I would challenge you to consider checking out Dr. Von Tracy. I work hard to make a living, and I'm not one to throw my hard-earned money away on just a good dentist. That's why it took me a couple of years to find a great dentist. From the excellence of his staff to the quality of the work, Dr. Tracy is the difference. I know it's time to put standards to our loyalty, so I would ask you to give Dr. Tracy a try by setting up your next appointment with him. Just go to VONTRACYDDS.com or call them at 509-466-6614. Again, sign up at VonTracyDDS.com. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. And so what I wanted to do is I'm trying to give you, I think, a high-level view of what was going on in these ratification debates. And one of the things that I think is really important is, and I mentioned this yesterday, that Hamilton was probably the most literate of the framers. And as a matter of fact, Washington was very, very impressed by him. The interesting thing, as I go down another tangent, is when Washington was the president, even though he had this great admiration for Hamilton, he did not go to Hamilton to write his speeches and so forth, at least not until Madison and Jefferson kind of fell out of Washington's graces. But up until the end of his first term, and it really wasn't until Jefferson and Hamilton went at it so much towards the end of his first term, where basically Jefferson kind of resigned going into the second term. And I believe that is when Washington was just, he felt fed up that there was all this bickering in his administration, and kind of put a cold shoulder to Hamilton, or not Hamilton, but to Madison and Jefferson. That's when he started relying a little bit more on Hamilton. A little other interesting thing, the farewell address to the United States from Washington, many people believe, and I believe personally, that that was the one that was written, because supposedly Washington went to Madison towards the end of his first term and said, "Would you please write a farewell address for me?" And Madison did that and gave it to him, and he kept that. And a lot of people say that that's the one that he used, and he kind of changed it and tailored it towards, you know, what he wanted to convey. And some people say that, well, he didn't use that because he went and supposedly asked Hamilton for the exact same thing. Give me a farewell address so that I can give this to the people of America. And if you read it, there is no way that some of those things that Washington said would have came from Hamilton. And I say that because Madison was very clear and consistent that we had to stick to the confines of the contract, that we had to follow the Article 5 process if you wanted to assume any new role, responsibility, or power. Hamilton believed in implied usurpations, that, well, we can do anything we want to, and he was the one that was trying to pursue the out-of-context use of the Supremacy Clause, Necessary and Proper, and so forth, that the Anti-Federalists were very concerned about. And that is why it is very important that we get into the ratification debates, to understand academically that how they defined the contract is what is legally binding. Everything that has been said, that have been hoodwinked, duped, and everything beyond the ratification from Hamilton, Marshall, and the rest of these people does not matter. It does not hold salt. The only things that defined the Constitution legally, that is legally binding, are the ratification debates. I can tell you that the Constitution provides anything green that you want, in, you know, on your plate, the federal government can give that to you. Or anything red on your plate that you eat, the federal government can take that from you. Well, there's just me asserting that, and there's nothing in the Constitution that states that. And it's very similar to what Hamilton and what Marshall were doing in trying to assert outside the boundaries of the enumerated powers that these clauses, these mystical clauses, the necessary, proper, the supremacy, commerce, and general welfare clauses, those clauses pertain to a greater and more ambiguous thing, when it was clearly defined in the process of the ratifying, which makes it legally binding. So in a court of law, it doesn't matter how you try to redefine it. It only matters during the contract negotiations and or ratification process, how it was defined, because that's how it was sold. If you were sold on the concepts of these definitions, then those are the only definitions that are applicable. And I hope this makes sense. Because, in other words, if you're able to redefine and change the definitions after you've signed the contract, then we could be duped in every single contract that we buy into, whether it be a mortgage, whether it be your cell phone, or anything else. And that is not the case. That's one of the reasons why a lot of companies really basically skate on very thin ice when they try to change their contractual agreements with you while you're in the middle of that contract. And unless they're giving you benefits, 9 times out of 10, they have to tread on very thin ice, because you can take them to court, because all of a sudden they're constraining you more than you actually agreed to. That's one of the reasons why these monopolies like Comcast and Time Warner and so forth, they will try to give you more bandwidth with your internet providing, but then on the back end, they're basically doing more snooping and controls and so forth, because I definitely know that Comcast, actually has limitations. They don't tell you in their contract, or they don't disclose that clearly, that says, you know what, we're going to limit you to a, what is it, a terabyte of data? I think they limit your downloads in a month. Regardless of how fast your speed is, you can only download a terabyte, which is a huge limitation. And I think I've gone down a rat hole here, but bottom line, the ratification debates were clearly those definitions that are the only definitions legally binding, regardless of what Hamilton and other constitutionalists or people in positions of power have asserted. And the interesting thing, as I've always pointed out, is that Madison was the one that maintained consistency as he redefined things. He didn't redefine it. He just re-emphasized how it was defined originally. That's why in his veto of the bonus bill, he was just basically re-emphasizing those exact same words that were used during the ratification debates. I've heard some people say that Madison volleyed back and forth. He may have volleyed back and forth in his personal writings and in his journals and so forth, but when it came to official correspondence, he was rock solid in what he was doing. So anyway, Hamilton, during this Article 1, Section 8 thing, and I just want to speak to, you know, what, maybe he was a very arrogant man, I don't know, but when somebody gets into a lecture in political theory, when you're talking about the limitations of power, then you have to scratch your head, what the heck is he doing? Is he just trying to impress people that he understands so much? And just like in the Times and the Federalist Papers, Hamilton really fails to get to the point and uses theory to support his argument instead of just plainly telling people, this is the limitations and this is it, period. That's what I loved, and that's why I read it again yesterday. Madison basically says, hey, these are the powers that are listed, and that's it. That's all they can perform, and there's no more they can perform. Just that. I mean, how much more to the point can you be than Madison was? But Hamilton wanted to get into this big prowess of, you know, impressing people on his academic knowledge of history and politics and so forth. So keep in mind, Hamilton wanted, also you got to keep in mind that going into the Constitutional Convention in his conveying to Madison, he wanted to have a permanent president, more of a monarchy. And even after the Constitution, he was still kind of pushing for that. And that was a part of the Federalists trying to self-aggrandize. And that was why Madison and a lot of I wouldn't say a lot, but more and more Federalists over time during Washington's tenure and definitely during Adams' tenure, Federalists were starting to migrate away from the Federalist Party because they started playing their hand as nationalists that wanted to create a huge central monolithic government. And I think they were actually being exposed. I realize that I've rambled and rambled so much that I'm not going to be able to get into some of these highlights that I have. But I wanted to also get into one other little point of fact for you, that during this Article 1, Section 8 debate, Hamilton and Lansing, both who were delegates at the Constitutional Convention, started, actually Hamilton made his address, his lofty address of academes, and or his academic argument, and Lansing got into a heated altercation after his remarks and basically exposed some of the remarks that Hamilton had during the Constitutional Convention. So he's kind of exposing him. And it was kind of noted as, you know, maybe it was like a catfight or a little brouhaha. But that was one of the highlights, I think, of really when the tone started stepping up. The interesting thing was right after they were doing this is when Virginia had, they received word that Virginia had ratified the Constitution, and it literally changed, I believe, the tone. Even though the argument, they were still fighting and scratching, they still lost it. So folks, tomorrow I'm going to be getting into more of the New York ratification debates. I'll provide some of the Virginia, but you have a good day. We'll be back tomorrow for those who are on air and those who are on streaming and on Red State Talk Radio. We actually will also cover not only some of the ratification debates, I'm going to get into the Federalist Papers as well tomorrow and provide you some insights as to what Hamilton, when he got into some of these lofty arguments, I think he lost people, because a lot of people would just read that and people would just go, what? And I've seen this before, where we have these individuals who are literally just going on and burying you with an academic argument that really just becomes like this circular nosedive. And you end up, I think the tactic is that you end up surrendering, go, that's it, uncle, tell me where to sign, I'm done, I don't want to hear anymore. And it's those types of tactics I think Hamilton was using. Anyway, we're out of here for Red State Talk Radio. I will be back tomorrow. God bless.